Art is in the making. It's not what you end up with. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, February 11th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, those are the words of artist Roger Brower. He and Donald Montolo are honored this week as part of the Governor's Awards in the Arts ceremony. We'll talk with both artists about their work. We'll explore the isolation of the studio and the collaboration of an exhibition. We'll talk about the creative process, mentoring young artists, and how to separate recognition from artistic expression. Plus, teachers aim to create classrooms where every student can learn, but some students are more sensitive to those environments than others. Our Teacher Talk conversation considers the needs of what we're calling orchid children. That's later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. This week, the Governor's Awards in the Arts ceremony is happening in Fort Pierre. You heard the voices of two award recipients on yesterday's program. We are continuing our coverage today. We'll start with a recipient of the Outstanding Support of the Arts to Native Nations with Lands in South Dakota Award. The Dreamcatchers Artist Guild curated artist-led exhibitions across the state. They also redefined Lakota art into what some call Lakota-centric. The Dreamcatchers Artist Guild started with three members and grew from there. Today, we bring you my conversation with one of the Guild's members, Donald Montolo. He joined us from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City.
The originator was Vic Reynolds. And he had this wonderful idea that as a group of artists, we were more able to showcase our art in better places, bigger places, because all of us were working at that time. And we said, you know, we can all get at least three or four pieces, but then with the number of us together, you know, that takes up a lot of gallery space. So that was kind of the idea that Vic had. And so he started pitching it to all of us artists who were really kind of out there all alone trying to promote ourselves. And he sold everybody on the idea. And that was back in, the first time we had a showing was in 1987 at the Sioux Indian Museum here in Rapid City. So it was quite an adventure.
What was it like to see what other people were bringing to the table you made your own work?
Well, we were all pretty familiar with each other because we all had been doing, you know, shows throughout the country. Mm-hmm. So we all knew each other's styles, and we were all really diverse in our styles too. I mean, I don't think any of us were doing anything similar to each other. Maybe that's what Vic's good idea was too, that the diversity of all of us, you know. So, and you know, we had some, you know, well-known artists with us too as well. And probably Arthur Ament had the most recognition of all of us, you know. But as a group, what was really cool and extraordinary was Vic pitched us to the IHS hospital that was just being built in Pine Ridge. Okay. And as a group, we was able to fill that hospital up with artwork. And so we got a real good commission there. And then Rosebud Hospital was, you know, also going to be built. And so Vic pitched us again, and so we had that one, and then we went to Sisseton. So it was really cool because as a group, we could really had more power rather than an individual artist to showcase our work.
Yeah, and being in those healthcare spaces, being in those community spaces, and bringing art to those spaces, were you thinking about how that, you know, versus a blank wall or a generic hospital piece of art? That's a big impact for the patients and families.
Yeah, you know, and even today, the artwork is still up in those places, and we still get a lot of compliments. I get my artwork, I did six huge panels. I think there were 6-foot by 10-foot panels, and they were all in the waiting room of the hospital. So I get a lot of comments of people, you know, with a lot of time on their hands sitting there, and they're saying, you know, and then they also have a little background music to them too as well. So they say, you know, your paintings really move sometimes when we're sitting in that waiting room. And I think, oh, you know, that's a cool compliment to have, you know.
Tell us a little bit about how you use color and motion in your art to create that movement. That's something that I don't know we can really even describe on the radio. But please try so people get a sense of that.
Say, picture this, huh? Well, yeah. I like bright colors. I like bold reds, blues, yellows, you know. And I think my least favorite color is probably green. But that's also the colors of our people, too, north, west, south, and east. You know, those are directional colors as well. And I think that when we were showcasing our art as a group, that's the one thing that unified the art itself, because all of us was using those same colors in our pieces. And they were all bright colors. You know, everybody really uses bright colors, except for Roger Brewer. He's kind of a more of the darker colored and penciled areas. But Roger, he has a real uniqueness of his colors. He just very, very little spot of color, but yet it jumps off the canvas so well. So all of us, that was what unified us together, was the brightness of our colors.
Yeah. You talk in your mission statement, and I was just talking with another group of artists about Oscar Howe.
Oh, yeah.
And the sense of authenticity and portraying people in an honest way, but also in an imaginative way. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about how you think about authenticity in your work, but yet not hyper-realistic. You're allowed to have an imagination and play with that paint as well.
Well, Oscar was one of my teachers. I taught in my sophomore and junior year in high school. I went to workshops with Oscar in the summertime, and he really had a great influence on me throughout my life. And Oscar, I think being so young and so pliable, that he really emphasized the fact that when you do a piece of artwork, it has to have something behind it. It just can't be there, you know. It has to have meaning. And he said, our art that we do has a story behind them. Everything has something that's either spiritual or everyday life. That's what we're portraying. And so I think that really stuck with me a lot, too, is because, like, I think even though some of my younger work was bold, abstract paintings, they all had a geometric design that was related to our beadwork and quillwork. And those in themselves was an abstract of mountains and rivers and things, streams like that, but they all had meaning. But then when you put the color on top of that, then it really created something. So even though they were very hard-edged and they still had a lot of definition and meaning to them as well.
Tell me a little bit about this idea of a fresh aesthetic that's Lakota-centric, getting beyond, hey, this is Indian art, this is Native American art, this is tribal art, and saying this is Lakota-centric art. Yeah. What does that mean for people?
That's a tough question because there are such a wide variety of artists that are with us today, you know, and young artists coming up today. Yeah. And I think that they all are really experimental in the new things that are there for us today too, especially with the computers and things like that. And,
right.
Marlena Miles, I don't know if you're familiar with her or not, but she's in Minnesota, and she does some really great things with computers.
Okay.
And she makes just wonderful things move. But all the things that we have today was all related to those young people, like Oscar Howe. He really probably was one of the ones that's most recognized. But we also had Herman Red Elk and Andrew Stenensoldier and a lot of those people that were just expressing themselves in everyday life. And I think that today, I think those people like Oscar and Herman and Andrew Stenensoldier, they probably was at the door, knocking on the door. And then when Arthur and Roger and us Dreamcatchers came, we kind of pushed that door open a little bit. But then as younger artists coming now, they really start going inside and really showing so many different varieties of art that the Native Americans can express themselves in that can really showcase. And it's so modern. Like you look at Oscar Howe's pieces,
yeah,
those pieces are relevant today as they were back then, you know, in 1960s. Yeah. The colors are so brilliant. His media and even his style. I mean, if he went into like an art show today, I mean, he'd blow everybody away. He'd take, if he put three in, he'd go 1, 2, 3. You know, he just has that flair. And I don't think any of us as dream catchers, we all appreciated his knowledge and his style, but we had that sense that we had to learn ourselves how to express ourselves too, just as much as he did.
Yeah. How did you learn to trust yourself that you would bring something to the canvas or to the ledger, to the project, to the book, that was different than what somebody else would, you know, you have to trust that you have something to say. Was that difficult for you to learn?
Yeah, it was.
How to do?
It was difficult because when I was in Santa Fe at the Institute of American Indian Arts, they really let us have freedom to express ourselves. But when I came back home, I really wanted to know who Native Americans were because I had no sense of being an Indian. I had no sense of being who I was inside. And so I really talked to a lot of the older people. I talked to a lot of grandmas and grandpas, and I heard a lot of stories. But then I also heard about this one thing that was ledger art, and that was what happened after buffalo hides became scarce, and we had to go and barter with soldiers to acquire their used ledger books. But images told our stories. Words tell your stories. So I really got a sense of, okay, I don't want to be a flat two-dimensional artist. I don't want that. So I started exploring on how to be a three-dimensional on a two-dimensional surface. And if you ever go to one of these big cities and you look at the sidewalk art that they're doing, the chalk art, you walk up to these pieces and you go, whoa, I think I'm going to fall in this piece. And you go, I'm going to back up. Well, that's the sense that I want people to have when they look at my ledgers, is I think I want that horse to jump off that page. I want him to just become something that's flying at you rather than a flat image that's just sitting on that page.
Yeah. I love that. You have also been devoted to arts education across the state.
Oh.
What excites you about some of the young artists that are coming up, even if they don't become full-time artists and they go into other fields, but yet you see the kind of way their minds are thinking and they're engaging artistically?
I have books that I've written and illustrated, and I got to go to schools to talk to young kids, and then mostly like I do kindergarten all the way through high school. Yeah. And the different ranges and ages, they have so much maturity in what they're trying to present than we had when we was young. I don't know, maybe I was a hippie back in the 60s, so I had this little crazy drive with my beads, you know. But they have a drive too as well. But I think they're limited though, because we don't have arts in the school anymore, and that's really a big deal. Because I was an art teacher, and I think that they're shorted so much in their education by not having the arts in the schools. Because if they did, you know, they wouldn't have to be like, you know, bootlegging on the side trying to do their art when you have a qualified individual who has experienced those ranges, you know, to teach them, to be there with them. And I think that as a traveling artist, and especially with the South Dakota Arts Council, when they put these artists into the schools and settings, that they really let that individual start growing and processing and really experimenting more as an artist.
Yeah. So I'm curious to what you think about expanding on what you said about somebody who's kind of doing their art on the side.
Yeah.
There are so many artists that have, some of them want another job and then to do art, but many want to make a living at their art because that is a job.
Right.
And that is the profession that they want. what do we need to do to support the artists who would really serve all of us if that was their full-time job? Because they're going to create things with impact and thought and skill and legacy. They're going to move it forward, but they need the time to do it. How do you think about that?
Well, I think that we'd have a lot of Oscar Howells running around the country. Arthur Amos, Don Montlose, Roger Brewers. And, you know, Richard Adams. Because that's what we do. We, in our maturity, we've already went through that, had to work for a living. And now we're all set up in a studio and things like that, so we can make our art better each day. Every time I walk into my studio, I don't really know what I'm going to put down on a piece of paper. But the more I start drawing away, and then some image actually starts evolving and coming up, and then I start working on that piece. Well, that's where I have an advantage over every artist out there that hasn't had that studio time. Because I know Roger Brewer and I, we both have good studios, and we both walk into our studios in the morning and we start creating, and we walk out in the evening with a really a sense of pride and something of accomplishment. And I think we're shorting the younger people by not giving them that sense of creativity or that sense of accomplishment in the field that they want to be in. We're all not going to be doctors and lawyers, you know, but artists are the ones that really historically have really showed what we did all the way back to the original time, you know, from cave drawings, you know. So we need art. We need art in schools, and we need art in our everyday lives.
So if you meet a young artist and they say that, what you just said, that's what I want. I want to walk into my studio, not necessarily know what I'm going to do, and then leave at the end of the working day feeling like I accomplished something and that I'm a working artist, but I don't know how to get there. Tell me how to get there. What would you say?
Well, first of all, there's some really good grants that you can apply for with South Dakota Arts Council. And okay. As a mentor, I've mentored several artists. And that's exactly what happens, is because we have enough money so we can bring that individual. Are we now with Zooming and, you know, with the technology that we have today, we can be across the state and still mentor young artists and showcase them. And it's drawing. It's getting a piece of paper, putting it on a desk with a pencil and just start drawing. And then as you draw, well, then how do I develop this? You know, what do I do now? What do I do? Colored pencils? Do I do Prisma pencils? You know, what are the best media of colored pencils to use to create that piece of artwork? Well, you have to show that. And then what type of paint is the best paint? You know, there's cheap watercolor paint that you can get, you know, in those little plastic things, or there's really expensive watercolor paper that you can have. But as a mentor, as a mature artist teaching a young person, you know all those things. And those are the things that you can actually show a young person who wants to be me or somebody that's good, an artist. You give them the tools. You have to have the right tools to create something lasting.
Yeah. Well, you have created so many lasting things.
Thank you.
So have the Dreamcatchers Artist Guild. Anything else that you want to say about the future of this group?
Well, we're getting older and we're all not here anymore, you know. And I think we just got to continue to, you know, there's going to be a legacy of Oscar Howe. I'm part of that legacy, and Dreamcatchers are a part of that legacy. Well, Dreamcatchers are a part of the legacy for future artists as well, too, so that they can look back on us and say, okay, thank you guys for getting Indian art out there, not only to the North American continent, but worldwide. You know, so our artwork as a group, each of us have actually been worldwide artists. We've showcased our art someplace in the world other than right here in Rapid City or South Dakota itself.
Isn't that remarkable? Well done. Yeah. Just well done. I have to feel. Go tell your 12-year-old self that that's what you were going to do. What would he say?
God, if I told him that, he'd probably say, yeah, right. You know, I've always wanted to be an artist. And I think ever since I've been 5 years old and drawn Mickey Mouse, I've always wanted to be here. And this is an extraordinary thing to be honored by the South Dakota governors, you know, and for Dreamcatchers. I mean, this was a plan that we didn't know was going to happen or not, but we were very happy that it did. And I'm very happy that we got this honor, even though all of us won't be there to accept it.
That's artist and art educator Donald Montalo. We'll hear from another member of the Dreamcatchers Artist Guild after the break. You're in listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Before the break, you heard from artist Donald Montalo. He's a recipient of the Governor's Awards in the Arts this week as part of the Dreamcatchers Artist Guild. Now, Roger Brower will also be recognized for his work with that guild, but he is also receiving the Distinction in Creative Achievement Award as part of the Governor's Awards in the Arts. Brower is an enrolled member of the Oglala Lakota Nation. He's known for his expressive paintings and monotype prints. His work is inspired by a combination of stories from the Oglala Lakota Oyate and his personal life. He joined us from SDPB's Black Hill Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City.
You know, as an artist, you spend all of your time alone. And I was trying to think about what I could say at the award ceremony. And that's really, really difficult because I'm alone. An artist, you spend your time thinking not so much about how the public is going to accept your work, but that you're doing work that's meaningful. I'm always trying to stay out just a little bit on the edge of my comfort zone. You don't know if it's going to be accepted or not. And I've been at this so long that it's come to the point where it really doesn't matter anymore. I'm painting things that are meaningful to me. I do subject matter that's very precious to myself. And I hope that people can find some little message in what I do that relates to them personally.
It's such a great insight into the process, though, which is, you know, you talked about just being, you know, in solitude with your own imagination and watching something develop. Do you surprise yourself in the studio sometimes?
You know, that doesn't happen very often, but several months back, I stepped back after I finished getting, I work in a form called a monotype. The idea, I start with an idea and just let it develop itself. On that day, I stepped back after I'd put down what I was going to put down. And toward the end, I was like watching myself work. Mm. And that's really magical when that happens. This award comes as a bit of a surprise because I didn't think I'd ever get any kind of notoriety like this. This is big to me. But it's not about just necessarily all about me. I want this want young people to understand that what they're doing is meaningful as long as they're being truthful to themselves and following their own vision, not what somebody else is demanding of them or wanting from them. It's first of all, they have to be accepting of what they are gifted to do.
Mm-hmm. With young artists especially, what do you think gets in their way?
Well, I think young artists, and I went through that time too. I've been at this more than 50 years, but it's just like it just started yesterday. But young artists get trapped into doing subject matter that they know they think will sell. So they're concerned with sales more than they are with the art. Art is in the making. It's not what you end up with. So these young people become very product-oriented, try to do something that they think is going to grace someone's walls, and they're going to be able to support themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that they just need to know that young people need to know that they, first of all, are not in this for the profit. They're in it for the art.
Yeah.
And that art has to occur from within themselves. I want to tell young people, young artists starting out, to put aside that thing of sales, but mm-hmm. make good art first and yeah. make themselves happy with what they're putting out from the end of their fingers.
In other interviews, you've said you've seen great artists, you know, wander away from the practice. You also need heart to stay with this. You need a certain amount of what? Is that intangible? What do you mean by that? You need to have heart to do it.
You have heart. You have to have heart to stay with this. Mm-hmm. Because there are many, many times that you're alone, that you're alone with your own imagery in your head or in front of you or maybe from a sketch or whatever. But it takes a lot of heart to stay with it and believe in what you're doing.
Tell people a little bit about the process of monotype as you have adapted it for your own, purposes and visions.
Okay, the way I do the monotype, I don't have that access to a press or any of those kinds of pieces of equipment. I use very simple handmade tools. I work with oil. I don't use printer's ink because I think it's sticky and smelly and I just don't care for it. But I use oil paint, just regular oil paint, and use a 4-inch brayer or 2-inch brayer, which is an ink roller, printmaker's tool. And then I work the piece on a piece of plexiglass or any other non-absorbent surface. And then I lay the paper on top of the plate and very carefully hold it in place and burnish the back of the paper. And what I'm pulling up is whatever I put on that plate is coming up. Mm-hmm. But it's backward. So I have to, and that's pretty easy for me because I'm kind of a backward person anyhow. So
it suits you, yeah.
Yeah. So I've captured enough of the message that I'm trying to put out, or the image that I'm trying to put out. I can put that aside, and come back to it later and add, Prismacolor or crayon or whatever else I want to do to it. It's still a monotype. It's not a monoprint because a monotype is a little bit different in definition. If I'm happy with it, I frame it up and put it in the pile.
What is the role of playfulness or whimsy is not the right word? Sometimes I look at your work and I just smile.
Well, that's good. That's
what's
good.
What's making me smile there? Often I look at your work and I just feel lucky to be looking at it.
Well, thank you, Lori. I think really good art should incite one of the other emotions, an emotion or a feeling or one of the other senses, if you will. Leave a taste in your mouth, or maybe a metallic taste, or maybe it should bring you a smile, or some other kind of thing in the person that's looking at it, maybe confusion. Life is kind of like that. I want people to be able to feel free to feel an emotion. Maybe they're not gonna. I don't care if people like it. I sell work to people that really don't care for it, but it makes them feel something, and they want to live with it. And to me, that's enough. That's enough. I don't do pretty.
Yeah.
I very rarely do anything that's pretty.
Makes them feel something, and they want to live with that feeling, and then they want to live with the art. Wow. We've talked a lot this week. We have a few conversations coming up or have been aired recently about Oscar Howe and his legacy and the Oscar Howe Summer Art Institute. Through your work with that Summer Art Institute, it's kind of hard to express to people the impact that it has on the art world. And when you put a bunch of conversations together, it starts to become really clear. What do you want to say about that art institute and its impact in the art world?
I've been involved with, I was initially with the initial group that Oscar invited to work with him that first summer. I was invited to come to that, but I couldn't because I lived over in Washington. It was just too far away, and I didn't have the financial means to make that trip. And I feel really kind of, that's one of the opportunities I feel I've missed. But I've worked with this Oscar House Summer Arts Institute off and on since its inception, actually. I usually go over every year and do a little bit of a mini workshop with the students that are there and try to encourage them to express themselves, to not be afraid, not be intimidated by the materials or the cost of things, the things that get in the way of young people's development. Mm-hmm. And I just try to encourage them to pursue a college or in some other institute like the Institute of American Indian Art in Santa Fe. I try to get young people interested in pursuing their dream. Yeah. And to have a dream and to trust it. Mm. And that's who I am. That's what I do, you know.
So. Was there a time that you did not trust your own dream?
Oh, when my children were small, I guess. I thought, I left my last job in 1979.
Wow.
And my wife worked as a school teacher. She taught kindergarten. And there were times when kids needed shoes or clothes or, you know, things that kids need growing up. And there were times when I thought, well, maybe I should just give this up and go get a job. And my wife just kept encouraging me. She said, no, this is what you do, and you're going to do it. No, we'll get through this. And with that encouragement, I just kept going. I still to this day have times when I think, well, why am I doing this? Well, I'm doing this because I have to.
Yeah.
I have no choice. It's not a burden. But sometimes you just have to believe in what you're doing and just keep going.
Your art has been exhibited so many times. It's been awarded and recognized. And it's in many collections, including some pretty impressive collections around the country, around the world. When you think of these different pieces in different places that have a life of their own, you know, that you might not ever know who stood in front of it and what they saw and what they thought and how it changed their day or even their life or their own art practice, what does that feel like for you to have that kind of reach?
You can't think about it.
Sorry, I retract the question.
You can't really think about it too much because then it becomes a commercial, a commercial venture.
Okay.
And I don't ever want it to become that. I just want it to be as meaningful as it can possibly be on its own merit.
Okay.
You know. Yeah. I don't really care too much about, you know, 1978 I did a show in Paris with Pierre Cardin.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the thing that kicked me and said, well, maybe I could do this.
Yeah.
Maybe I could do this. And opportunities come and you have to just very carefully move ahead.
Yeah.
You know, that's all.
That moment in the studio is the where you get outside of the studio, whether it's in nature or with you know, animals or people. Where are you finding some of that artistic inspiration that then shows up when you're by yourself in your studio space?
Oh my goodness! If you saw my studio, you'd say, "God, there's all kinds of inspirational stuff here." Most of it's cardboard and boxes. Yeah, I find inspiration everywhere. I live my art. This isn't something I just do when I feel like it. I go to the studio every day. I tell my students, no matter, you know, even on those days you don't feel inspired or interested in making art, you have to go make something every day.
Yeah.
You have to keep your hand in it. You have to keep your heart in it. And just keep going and going. And even on those days when I don't feel inspired or don't have an idea that I want to work through, I do something every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's nothing more than cleaning my palette or some mundane activity, usually when I mess with my materials, something will pop into my head, you know. And I think that's, but you know, not everybody has that opportunity to have their materials out all the time. I have a studio, and I'm very lucky to have a space that I can do that. But
So maybe we'll just close with something about collaboration. And you know, we talk so much about being alone, but then there's also this moment where artists are with one another.
You know, I think it's important for artists to converse with other artists, not necessarily about things, you know, that, you know, life things, but to talk with other artists about where their ideas are, how they develop an idea. Look at how this idea is going to finish before they start. And not let that be the guiding force of developing an idea to whatever you're doing, and that it translates into music, translates into dance, it translates into all the arts. Without art in our lives, we are a culture that is not developed. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing the political things about taking money away from National Public Radio and doing away with programs that are so important to the culture, not necessarily to individual lives, but to the culture in general. And I think that's just, it's really a sad time we're facing now, but we have to continue, even if we don't have the conveniences of radio and the necessity of radio or in television, we still have to continue producing. We still have to make something.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Teachers strive to create classrooms where every student can learn, but some students are more sensitive to their environments than others. I happen to have been one of those students. So this week on Teacher Talk, Jackie Wilbur and Gina Benz and I are considering and celebrating the so-called Orchid Children Among Us. Gina Benz is a high school teacher at Roosevelt in Sioux Falls. She's an adjunct professor at Augustana University, the University of Sioux Falls, and the University of South Dakota. She's in her 25th year of teaching. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center of Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota's School of Education. We all remember what it's like to be a kid in school. If we went to school, we remember these sort of key moments and we reflect on them again and again and again as adults when we think about public school. I find that fascinating.
You are not alone in this experience, Lori. And I think one of the things that I find most interesting about the work that I do, working with people who are about to be teachers, is that there is this sense of remembering what it was like to be a student or knowing what it's like to be a parent and watching your children go through school. And then there's this other side of being at the front of the classroom. And so all of your questions, I think, have been a really good reminder to me about what it's like to be not at the front of the classroom and be wondering about why we do things the way we do. Mm-hmm. And to remind us too what the experiences are like to not be at the front and to bring those perspectives into the conversation.
Yeah. So you went looking for orchid children. Because your host was a very sensitive child. I like this terminology because I've been called things a lot worse than orchid child, let me tell you.
Well, I would like to disclaim, I said in the companion blog as well that I would never label you anything, and I don't know if you would self-identify as an orchid child, but one of the stories you shared with us after one of our talks made me think about this article, and I hadn't actually read it since 2009 when it came out in The Atlantic. And it's actually a very lengthy article about really in-depth science about genetics that I don't claim to understand. I certainly didn't at the time, and I was no better this time around. But the way the author was explaining the science in this story, he used this folklore or folk wisdom from Swedish culture, which talks about the idea of dandelion children. And dandelion children are our most children. They're hardy, they can grow anywhere. From the crack in the sidewalk to a really well-tended garden, you're going to see dandelions spring up everywhere. But orchid children, they need special care. You know, they need a greenhouse, they need an expert, and those children can bloom into all kinds of spectacular and wonderful things, just like orchids themselves can. But if the conditions aren't right, it can be really difficult to see them bloom.
Yeah. And Gina, when you think about that in high school, do you still see high school students that, would reflect a heightened sensitivity and heightened artistic nature, or even a, combative or difficultness that shows if the conditions aren't quite right, or maybe aren't just right, that you're going to see behavior show up in the classroom, or you're going to see them struggle in some ways? How did this land with you, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
For sure, it still can show up in high school, but I would doubt it shows up as much as it does in elementary school because by the time students are in high school, they've developed strategies that help them through those emotions they feel or strategies that help them mask what they're feeling. And so the orchid child idea doesn't resonate with me so much as a high school teacher, but when I get in the elementary schools with my teacher pathway teachers, then I can see it more often.
Yeah. What are some of the ways, because Jackie, you mentioned the story I had, which is kindergarten when we had to bring a nap mat. I don't know if anybody does that anymore in kindergarten, but we had to bring a mat to school and leave it there. And my mother handmade me a little sleep mat. And throughout the entire day, I was absolutely obsessed with the location and the protection of the sleep mat. Refused to leave it at school. And the kindergarten teacher, the lovely Mrs. Schneff, sent a note home and said, "Perhaps you want to bring, send something with Lori that is a little less precious to her because this was really something she had a hard time with throughout the day." And so I'm sending it home with her, even though the intention was that it would live at the classroom. That's a very sensitive kindergarten student, I think. I love that my mother saved that. Actually, it was my father who saved the note, probably because he did the scrapbooks. But I love that they saved that note and preserved it for all time.
Yeah, there was just something about it that made me, and I feel like that story about you, and then the way that you posit questions to us when we are talking about what I would say are primarily dandelion classroom strategies. You know, so much of what we talk about is for the masses, because that's who we're teaching to. We're teaching to the public, and we've got the vast majority of the things that we discuss are for the vast majority of students. But there are these occasions where there's unique circumstances and certain things that pop up, and we have to adapt to those too. And so I've noticed, Lori, that when we have these conversations, you never fail to think of the orchid children. And so we'll be talking about something that's kind of not one size fits all, but one size fits most. And you never fail to say, what about the one that that's not going to work for? What are we doing there? And so I just wanted to acknowledge that that is something I've noticed that you've done throughout these conversations and talk a little bit more about it.
Yeah.
I'd like to add that a little teaser for an upcoming episode. I will be talking about social emotional learning. And I think that is our number one strategy as teachers to help provide the support and resources for these orchid children, because it helps us better understand them, it helps them better understand themselves, and it helps their peers better understand them. So I will talk more in depth about social emotional learning, but essentially it is helping students have compassion for one another and an awareness for the unique talents and needs everybody brings to a community.
So what does that say about resilience, though? What, because, you know, we're trying to raise resilient children, which most kids are naturally in some ways. What does that say about education and resilience? Like, because here's what happens when you're one of these kids. People tell your parents all the time that they have to toughen up. Or they have to learn to deal with, you know, like, well, they just have to learn to deal with the world. My parents would always say, that's just the world. You know, that's just, life's not fair.
There's a lot of dandelion.
I'm surrounded by dandelion. And I love dandelions. I love them. Right? However, there were often times when I was like, yeah, no, there's more to it than that. There's more to it. So what does say about resilience? Yeah. Go ahead, Gina.
What happens in high school, in my experience, I'm sure this happens at other levels as well, is that we don't ask students to dive in 100% with whatever is creating some big emotions. Instead, it's like, let's just do 20% or 10%. Mm-hmm. And so I guess you could call it exposure therapy, in that they do lean in to whatever's causing the distress, but they don't have to lean in fully, just lean in a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then the next time they'll probably be able to lean in a little bit more. I guess it's about patience and providing that support and encouragement.
Does this mean for teachers that if you are, and I don't want to leave the impression that every classroom needs to have a separate little greenhouse for certain children, but when you think about the fact that you're creating a classroom that is nourishing and supportive, the entire classroom can be the greenhouse. With all these other classroom, you know, management practices that you're saying, that could be it. Because home, for some kids, might be less supportive. And you as a teacher are providing the supportive environment that they thrive in. Am I on the right track, Jackie? Or am I off track?
Yes. No, I hear what you're saying. I think just to extend this garden metaphor a little bit more, if you think about, in general, all plants need sun and water and soil, right? And so that's going to be true for the orchid children and the dandelion children, right? There's going to be some basic things about creating structure in your classroom, being a warm demander, which Gina always talks about, having just some kind of base things that are going to be good for all students' well-being and optimizing their learning. And then in some ways, teachers are asked to create individualized greenhouses for the very specific needs of all the specific students that are in their classroom. And so while the vast majority of students are going to thrive kind of in the system as it is, right? The public school system has been working for most students for a very long period of time. We also still have accommodations and modifications, as well as just individualized plans for students who have specific needs. And one of the things that I find both refreshing and challenging about some of the questions that you asked, Lori, is that I feel like they're so often case by case. Like what little Lori Walsh needed to feel comfortable in certain situations, there wouldn't be a prescription to say, like, every time you have a Lori Walsh, you'll need to do blank, right? It's going to be really nuanced, or at least that's been my experience, to that student and that classroom at that time of day with what their circumstances are. And then it might change the next day. That's the way orchids are too. They're really fickle. You're like, wow, I was watering it this way for a period of time and now that's not working anymore. And so that's my long extended gardening metaphor.
Each week of Teacher Talk includes bonus material on our podcast and on the companion blogs on our website. You can find the podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Search for SDPB's Teacher Talk. And online, sdpb.org/teachertalk. Share it with your favorite teacher, administrator, parent, or in this case, grown-up orchid child. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you from all of us here at SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.